conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. What do you know about slavery? Did you know that as well as African and African-American people, Native Americans, numbering in the millions, were also victimized by slavery, and that this went on for centuries, extending to California? We'll learn about the other slavery on today's Project Censored Show. We'll be playing a talk by historian Andres Resendez regarding his recent book, The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. Stay with us.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll learn about how Native Americans, by the millions, were subject to slavery in the Americas, beginning with Columbus and continuing for centuries afterward. We'll hear excerpts from a talk given this past April in Berkeley at the Hillside Club by UC Davis historian Andres Resendez about his book, The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. I had the privilege of hosting that event. Andres Resendez is professor and historian at the University of California, Davis. He is the author of A Land So Strange, The Epic Journey of Cabeza de Vaca, which Carolyn C. called impossible to put down in a Washington Post Book World article. And now let's hear Andres Resendez. It is an honor to be here. And with that, I give you Andres Resendez. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you all for carving out time from your lives to come here. It is a real honor that I'm able to share some of my work over the past 7 years with you. Thank you also to Bob and to Mickey for extending this gracious invitation. It is a real pleasure. So slavery is the topic at hand. And it's a word that brings to mind bodies of Africans stuffed in the hold of a ship or white apron maids bustling in an antebellum home. History books and movies continuously reinforce the notion that slaves were black Africans imported into the New World. We may be aware that in the long sweep of history, peoples other than Africans have been held in bondage, but we still seem unable to escape our historical myopia. So my recent book, The Other Slavery, tells about a system of bondage that targeted Native Americans, a system that was every bit as terrible, degrading, and vast as African slavery, and yet most Americans know relatively little about it or learn about it at school. According to my estimates, anywhere between 2.5 and 5 million Native Americans were enslaved throughout the hemisphere between the arrival of Columbus and 1900. So that compares with about 12.5 million Africans who were forcibly transported across the Atlantic. And interestingly, in contrast to African slavery, which targeted mostly adult males, the majority of Indian slaves were women and children. So the study of contrast is quite interesting. It was a very big deal, but somehow we have chosen to forget all about this. Just to get a sense of how neglected a topic this is, try this. Get into Amazon and type in African slavery. You will turn up more than 16,000 books and counting. However, if you type in Indian slavery, you will instead find works about the Indian Ocean and Southeast Asia, and just a couple of dozen specialized monographs on Native Americans held in bondage. The consequences are plainly visible today. Whenever the conversation turns to slavery, people typically imagine black slaves. Virtually no one ever thinks about Indians. It is as if each group could fit into a neat historical box. Africans were the ones enslaved, while Indians either died off or were dispossessed and confined to reservations. I have to start out by emphasizing that Indian slavery was not a European invention. Mayas and Aztecs took captives to use as sacrificial victims. Iroquois people waged campaigns on neighboring groups called mourning wars to avenge and replace their dead. In the Pacific Northwest out here, male Indians offered slaves as dowry to finalize marriages. Along with the rest of the planet, Native Americans enslaved one another for millennia. However, with the arrival of Europeans, these pre-existing practices of bondage, originally embedded in very specific cultural contexts, such as the ones that I just described to you, became commercialized, expanded in unexpected ways, and came to resemble the kinds of human trafficking that are recognizable to us today. This transformation began with the earliest European explorers. During his second voyage to America in 1493, Columbus sent dozens of Indians from the Caribbean. Accompanying them was a candid letter addressed to the Spanish monarchs. And let me just quote one sentence from that. "May your highnesses judge whether these Indians ought to be captured, for I believe we could take many of the males every year and an infinite number of women. And may you also believe that one of them would be worth more than 3 black slaves from Guinea in strength and ingenuity, as you will gather from those I'm shipping out now." There was a really widespread idea that peoples from the hot weather were more intelligent and made better slaves. So thus Columbus inaugurated the Middle Passage, complete with the overcrowding and high mortality rates that we commonly associate with African slavery, but which in fact can be traced back to this other and earlier slavery. Eventually, all European powers became important participants in the Indian slave trade. The English, the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese. But Spain, by virtue of the enormous and densely populated colonies that it ruled, became the dominant slaving power. Spain was to Indian slavery what Portugal and later England were to African slavery. Ironically, Spain began by forbidding the enslavement of Indians, yet this categorical prohibition did not stop generations of determined conquistadors and colonists from taking native slaves on a truly planetary scale, from the Canary Islands to the Philippines, from the tip of South America all the way to the northwest of what is now the United States, and even beyond that. And the fact that this other slavery had to be carried out clandestinely made it even more insidious. This is a tale of good intentions gone badly astray. Now, the Caribbean was the laboratory of conquest, and it was also the first, and quite likely the worst, native slaving ground in the world. At contact, the Caribbean sustained a large indigenous population. Yet, from this high point, a tragic demographic collapse followed. By the 1550s, merely 2 generations after contact, the natives, so memorably described by Columbus as affectionate and without malice, had ceased to exist as a people. As any schoolchild knows, smallpox was a major reason for this devastation. But blaming everything on unintended biological consequences is just too easy and not borne out by the sources. Take, for instance, Hispaniola, the island now shared by Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Italian demographer Massimo Livibacci has recently made the crucial point that the first certain documentation of smallpox in Hispaniola appears only in 1518. And yet, even though 26 years passed before the first documented cases of smallpox began to appear, the native population of the Caribbean found itself already on a clear path towards extinction. At contact, Hispaniola may have had a population that we can reasonably estimate at around 200,000 or 300,000 inhabitants. By 1508, that figure had fallen to 60,000. By 1514,
it stood at merely 26,000 according to a fairly comprehensive census, and no longer guesswork. These Indians were parceled out amongst Spaniards, and so therefore we have a very comprehensive census in that year. And by 1517, the number had plunged to just 11,000 Native Americans. What I'm trying to say with all of this is that 1 year before Europeans began reporting smallpox, Hispaniola's Indian population had dwindled to perhaps 5% or less of what it had been at contact. While it is impossible to rule out completely the possibility of unreported epidemics, it is obvious that other factors were at work in the early years. In fact, if you read the sources, all of it is littered with references to enslavement, to warfare, and to starvation. And one of the reasons is that actually Europeans found the largest deposits of gold in Hispaniola, in the Caribbean. And they quickly put the local residents to work. By 1510, the number of Indians of Hispaniola had plunged so drastically that the remaining population was no longer able to provide enough labor for the gold mines, let alone for planting and harvesting basic foodstuffs. And so, to replenish the dwindling workforce, European slavers fanned out to the neighboring islands, and thus the demographic cataclysm that had first occurred in Hispaniola spread out throughout the Circum-Caribbean region. We have very good, because you needed a license to actually go out and take Indians from one island and import them into Hispaniola, we have very good records about where these slaving expeditions originated, where they went, and so forth. And we can tell that, say, Jamaica, Puerto Rico, Cuba, and Hispaniola were the sending areas, and they went all over into the Bahamas, into the coast of Florida, into the northern coast of South America, what is now the coast of Venezuela and Colombia, taking Indians from all of these regions and bringing them to the areas where the gold mines were. Now, gold was the initial impetus for procuring large amounts of indigenous labor. In the United States, of course, when we think of gold, the unavoidable reference is to the California Gold Rush. Altogether, California produced some 3.7 million kilograms of gold, and in the process attracted some 300,000 people from the rest of the world. It was a major phenomenon, as all of you are well aware. Yet the exploitation of silver rather than gold was the preeminent Indian slavery activity in the early years. And let's just compare the California gold rush to the rush that I'm talking about, the silver rush that I'm talking about. In terms of duration, the California gold rush was like a hurricane. Gold production skyrocketed in 1849, but peaked only 4 years later. For all practical purposes, the California gold rush lasted less than 20 years. By contrast, the earlier silver boom started in the 1520s and grew through the 16th. It plateaued in the 17th, and it grew dramatically in the 18th centuries, attaining its highest watermark only in the first decade of the 19th century, so almost 300 years later. The silver boom would end up producing 44.2 million kilograms of silver, so about 12 times as much metal as the gold produced in California. So what you have to imagine to get a sense of the scope of what we're talking about is 12 California gold rushes strung out throughout the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. And remember that gold requires some superficial digging, as you know. Silver was rather more labor-intensive. You had to identify the silver, the outcroppings of silver, but then you had to follow the veins, usually down. Some of the shafts that were made in order to exploit the silver were some of the largest man-made shafts made in the world in some of these mines in what is central, southern, and northern Mexico. If this fantastic silver boom had occurred in the 19th century, these mines in Mexico, in what is now Mexico, would have become a worldwide magnet like California. In an era of newspapers, steamboats, and widespread transoceanic travel, there is little doubt that the great Mexican silver mines would have lured immigrants from all quarters of the world. But because this boom predated all of these communications and transportation conveniences and unfolded at a time when the Spanish monarchy prohibited all foreigners from going to the silver districts, Mexico had to make do with its own human resources, especially Indians. California attracted 300,000 people, yet colonial Mexico had to satisfy a hugely greater labor demand with no access to volunteers from the rest of the world. The Indians who lived around the mines were the first to be pulled into the quote-unquote system. Spanish soldiers and volunteers rounded them up and sold them to the miners for 30 to 50 pesos apiece, depending on their qualifications, etc. When the local Indian population became depleted, mining entrepreneurs looked farther afield. They eventually brought natives from a catchment area that expanded as far north as California, New Mexico, and Texas. Now, these connections between these mines in what is now Mexico and what is now the American Southwest are very relevant and explain much of the history of our region. Take, for instance, the situation of New Mexico. In the summer of 1680, the Pueblo Indians of that territory, of that kingdom, as it was called at the time, rose up and launched the most massive rebellion Spaniards experienced in North America since the early days of conquest. The nervous center of this movement was the Pueblo of Taos in what is now northern New Mexico. From inside a kiva, or underground chamber used for ceremonial occasions, a local shaman named Popey dispatched runners to more than 70 Indian communities, some of them as far away as the present-day Hopi Reservation in Arizona, some 300 miles away. And remember, these Pueblo Indians did not have horses, so all of these messages were sent with runners. So you can imagine sending runners to all of these 70 pueblos. This is occurring in the middle of the summer, so it was quite a feat to do all of these exchange of messages. Popey's plan was to get all of these indigenous communities to rise up on the same day to overwhelm the much smaller Spanish population living in the region. And to this end, these runners carried an extraordinary device, a cord of yucca fiber containing as many knots as there were days before the insurrection. By untying one knot every day, each community would know when to strike. The revolt swept through New Mexico on August 10 and 11, 1680, destroying houses, ranches, and churches, and succeeding mightily. Within 2 months, all Spaniards living in New Mexico were either dead or had been driven out of the territory, and they would remain outside of New Mexico for a period of 12 years. Now, writers have emphasized the religious aspect of the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. They have focused on the charismatic Popey and his ability to coordinate so many pueblos. These authors have also been rightly impressed by the burning and defacing of churches and the torturing of friars and the killing of friars during the uprising. Now, it is fair to say that the motives of people in remote times from our own is a explaining those motives is a dicey business. And of course, rebellions are seldom triggered by a single factor. However, in my book, I try to make the case that while religion was certainly important, the Spanish enslavement of New Mexican Indians played a major role in triggering this massive rebellion. For one thing, rebellious leaders explicitly talked about it. One of the demands of the rebels was that all classes of Indians forcibly held by the Spaniards be given back. One of the rebellion leaders also asked, and I quote, that his wife and children be given up to him, and likewise that all the Apache men and women whom the Spaniards had captured in war be turned over to them. It is also interesting to note that the geography of the uprising is just as suggestive about the importance of the Indian slave trade. Although the uprising is popularly known as the quote-unquote Pueblo Revolt of 1680, the movement actually encompassed a large swath of territory along the slaving corridors leading south from New Mexico to the mining region of Chihuahua and also west to what is now Sonora. So in other words, it's not only pueblos, but also Apaches and peoples from Sonora that were involved in this rebellion. And if you plot the area of rebellion against the corridors of enslavement, you will see that there's a very clear match between that. In other words, the silver economy, and in this particular case, one single mine called Parral in what is now southern Chihuahua, really explains a lot of what went on, a lot of the unrest of what went on in a place like New Mexico. Now, one of the most fascinating aspects of the phenomenon of Indian slavery is the involvement of Indians themselves. Native Americans participated in the enslaving enterprise since the very beginning of European colonization. Indeed, as I mentioned, they were involved in that since even before the arrival of Europeans. But when they participated with the European colonists, at first they played a secondary role to the Europeans, who, after all, possessed the most developed warfare technologies, and especially horses and firearms. Indigenous peoples became local suppliers, junior partners, guides, guardsmen, and intermediaries. But with the passage of time, Native Americans came to acquire European weaponry and horses of their own. And as they increased their power, they came to control a larger share of the traffic in natives. By the 18th and 19th centuries, they had taken control of much of the business. No other Indian nation attained the spectacular success of the Comanches, which became the preeminent suppliers of indigenous slaves to other natives, as well as to European colonists in the Southwest. Their expansive territory, wedged between New Mexico and Texas, and called the Comancheria, became a major trading center, as recent works by historians such as Pekka Hämäläinen, Brian DeLay, Joaquin Riballa Martinez, and others have made clear. So now let me give you a little bit of flavor of what that was. According to one witness, in 1744, Comanche trading parties traveled, and I quote, more than 1,000 leagues, so a league being about 3.5 miles, so more than 1,000 leagues, more than 3,000 miles, in the course of a year, acquiring captives and returning to offer their loot in the trading fairs of New Mexico. So the pueblos, some of the pueblos in New Mexico had fairs, and these equestrian societies, indigenous societies, came offering hides, but also offering captives. One missionary recorded the enthusiasm caused by the arrival of such trading embassies. And here I quote one of these. Here the governor and his lieutenants gathered together as many horses, metal tools, and everything possible as they can for trade and barter with these barbarians in exchange for deer and buffalo hides, and what is saddest, in exchange for Indian slaves, men and women, small and large, a great multitude of people. For Comanches themselves, the Indian slave trade was not just a business, but a way of life. Comanches sold some of their slaves, but they retained a large portion of their captives. One witness, for example, noted that, and I quote, nearly every family amongst the Comanches had one or two captives. Many of the captives were women who were incorporated in Comanche society as secondary wives and were put to work immediately. So Comanche men hunted bison, but the women were the ones who had to process the dead animals. So you can imagine a skilled hunter could fell down a number of buffaloes, which is like a ton of meat, rotten meat, rotting meat, and hides. And preparing that meat and curing the hides was an extraordinary labor-intensive activity. And so successful Comanche men could have 5, 10, or more wives. In addition to women, boys were the other significant contingent of slaves in the Comancherias. Their main occupation was tending the animals. As Comanches grew stronger, they accumulated horses and mules. That was almost like a sign of how wealthy you were, how many horses and mules you actually controlled. And managing all of these herds required a prodigious amount of labor that neither the warriors nor the women were able to provide. So it was not uncommon for such boy slaves to be in charge of a number of horses, 50, 100, 150, It was a very grueling work that required constant vigilance and enormous stamina, and it became especially difficult, as you would imagine, in the winter. If they grew to manhood, they could be allowed, some of these, you know, boy slaves could be allowed to marry low-status Comanche females, and with the passage of time, they could work their way into a status other than that of slaves. For Comanches and other groups, then, slaves constituted a very versatile commodity that could be used as an exploited underclass, as pawns that could be exchanged for kin members captured by other groups, or simply as the most ubiquitous form of currency in the region, the most effective form of currency in the region. Now, Indian slavery engulfed the entire American continent, but the timing varied depending on the region. By the 19th century, Indian slavery had nearly disappeared in the eastern seaboard of the United States. In colonial times, the Carolinas had been a major Indian slaving ground. New Englanders had impressed rebellious Indians and shipped them to the Caribbean. French colonies in eastern Canada had procured thousands of native captives from the interior, from the Great Lakes region. However, during the 18th and early 19th centuries, the traffic of natives was largely replaced and, at the very least, overshadowed by African slavery. Yet Indian slavery continued to thrive out here in the West. The best evidence comes from the letters and diaries of westbound Americans. In New Mexico, for example, James S. Calhoun, the first Indian agent of the territory, could not hide his amazement at the sophistication of the Indian slave market. And I quote him, "The value of the captives depends upon age, sex, beauty, and usefulness," he wrote. "Good-looking females are valued from 50 to 150 pesos each. Males, as they may be useful, one half less, never more." Calhoun met many of these slaves and actually wrote pithy notes about them. Similarly, out here, California may have entered the Union as a quote-unquote free soil state, but American settlers soon discovered that the buying and selling of Indians was a common practice. As early as 1846, the first American commander of San Francisco acknowledged that, quote, "Certain persons have been and still are imprisoning and holding to service Indians against their will," and warned the general public that, quote, "the Indian population must not be regarded in the light of slaves." His pleas, however, went unheeded. The first California legislature passed the so-called Indian Act of 1850, which authorized the arrest of vagrant natives who could be, quote-unquote, hired out to the highest bidder. This act also enabled white persons to go before a justice of the peace to obtain Indian children for indenture. According to one scholarly estimate, the Indian Act of 1850 may have affected as many as 20,000 California Indians, including 4,000 children kidnapped from their parents and used primarily as domestic servants and as farm laborers. So that's California. But the story was much the same in other parts of the West. Mormon settlers, for example, arrived in Utah in the 1840s looking for a promised land, only to discover that Indians and Mexicans had already turned the Great Basin into a slaving ground. The area was and is and remains like a gigantic moonscape of bleached sands, salt flats, and mountain ranges inhabited by small bands no larger than extended families. Early travelers did not hide their contempt for these so-called digger Indians, as they were known, lacking horses and weapons. They actually did not want to have horses because horses actually ate the grass, which was what they fed on. So it was an environmental situation. These vulnerable Paiutes had become easy prey, however, for mounted Indians. Brigham Young and his followers, by establishing themselves in the area, became the most obvious outlet for such captives. Hesitant at first, Mormons required some encouragement. Slavers tortured children with knives or hot irons to call attention to their trade, or threaten to kill any child that went unpurchased. Brigham Young's son-in-law, Charles Decker, witnessed the execution of an Indian girl before he acceded to exchange his gun for another captive. In the end, Mormons became buyers and even found a way to rationalize their participation in this human market. And I quote, "Buy up the Lamanite children." And the term Lamanite is the word that Mormons use to refer to Native Americans for reasons that I'd be happy to address in the questions. But that's what they mean, Indian children. So Brigham Young counseled his brethren and educate them and teach them the gospel so that many generations would not pass before they should become a white and delightsome people. So buy up the Indians and turn them into a white and delightsome people. That was his advice. And it was the very same logic that the Spanish conquistadors had used since the 16th century to justify the acquisition of Indians. Now, so persistent and widespread was Indian slavery that ending it proved nearly impossible. The Spanish crown had prohibited native bondage under all circumstances as early as 1542. That is called the New Laws of 1542. Yet the traffic continued. To retain mastery over the natives, European owners, in collusion with crown officials, resorted to a variety of euphemisms and subterfuges that amounted to slavery in all but name. Another attempt at abolition occurred in the early 19th century when the Independent Republic of Mexico prescribed all forms of native bondage and extended citizenship rights to all Indians born within the territory of Mexico. Yet Indian slavery persisted. One more opportunity arose immediately after the Civil War in the United States. The United States Congress passed the 13th Amendment, which prohibited both slavery and involuntary servitude. This particular formulation opened the possibility of liberation of all Native Americans held in bondage in the West. However, in various rulings in the 1870s and 1880s, the Supreme Court opted for a narrow interpretation of the 13th Amendment that applied primarily to African Americans and generally excluded Native Americans. Congress also passed an act abolishing the system known as peonage. This system was absolutely key to maintain this form of bondage in the West. And peonage was defined as, quote, "the voluntary or involuntary service of labor of any persons as peons in liquidation of any debt or obligation that exists in various Western states." So the idea was that by making it originally voluntary, right, so people who were in need of money would voluntarily sell their labor. So it was the fiction that it was voluntary and therefore it was not slavery. However, once you were in debt, you were unable to leave the place where you contracted this debt. And sometimes these debts were passed from parents to children. So it was a pretty onerous system. But the fig leaf was that because it had originated in a voluntary transaction, this was really not slavery. So Congress outlawed these with the Peonage Act of 1867, and it was an important step in the right direction. But the written word alone was not enough to eliminate these practices. So forms of native bondage continued through the 19th century and in some remote areas well into the 20th century. Remember, Native Americans were not fully made citizens of the United States until the 1920s. Now, today, 45.8 million people in 167 countries around the world live in some form of modern slavery, according to the latest estimate of the Walk Free Foundation. Slavery is forbidden all over the world, yet not a single region of our globe has been spared from this scourge. Slavery continues to thrive because its beneficiaries resort to debts or prison sentences or some other subterfuge to compel people to work under the threat of violence and offering absurdly low or no compensation. With this growing awareness about present-day slavery, what lessons can we derive from the 400-year experience of Native Americans with this other slavery. It seems to me that, first of all, the emphasis on the newness of the contemporary forms of bondage is myopic. Some scholars trace the beginnings of the new slavery to the end of World War II, or even to the economic liberalization of the 1980s and 1990s. They point to the dissolution of the Soviet Union as the origin of the sex trade involving Eastern European women, or the liberal reforms of the last 30 years as the main reason for children in third world countries toiling in sweatshops to make products for the developed world. One cannot deny that such developments indeed promoted and accelerated the traffic and exploitation of humans. But as I have tried to show in this brief presentation, the mechanisms of coercion that underpin such practices are much older. Only by contemplating this longer trajectory, we can gain a measure of the breathtaking dynamism and staying power of this other slavery and its related forms of involuntary servitude and the tremendous difficulties of ending it. Thank you very much.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will return soon, as will the rest of the Project Censored Radio team. This week on the program, we're listening to a talk by historian and author Andres Resendez. His latest book is The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. In the speech, he discussed how millions of Native Americans were conscripted into slavery from the time of Columbus to centuries later. Resendez spoke in Berkeley, California, April 2017. I was host of that event. After this musical break, we'll hear him answer some of the questions submitted by the audience. Stay with us.
We were talking backstage, we were talking about how it comes about that you write these kinds of books, and of course your research is borderlands, Mexico. You did your PhD at the University of Chicago 20 years ago, and you mentioned that it took you about 7 years to complete this. Okay. So talk a little bit about how you got into this and what the process was.
One of the most difficult things about writing that book is that I wanted it to be a very well-sourced, I mean, this is a controversial subject. I wanted it to be also a useful reference. If you are interested in Indian slavery in different regions, especially of the Southwest, I wanted to provide endnotes in this particular case that would lead you to the most relevant work on that topic. At the same time, I didn't want it to be a purely academic endeavor. I think this is an important story to tell, so I wanted to write it as engagingly as possible. And that is easier said than done, steering a middle course between an academic book and a trade book. It really slowed down my writing. I realized that the best way to write the book was, first of all, to try to give a stereophonic view of things. So sometimes I take the point of view of the enslaved. One chapter I devote to how the slavers actually looked at this. In another chapter, I looked at the Spanish crown and their efforts to stamp out slavery, and unsuccessful effort to stamp out Indian slavery. I bring in the Mexican perspective. I bring the U.S. perspective. So I tried to mix it up, and that was part of the fun of writing this book, but also part of the difficulty, mastering all of these things, finding the right sources. So in the end, I'm glad I did it. It took 7 years, as you point out, and a lot of headaches, and I'm glad it's done. So, yeah.
So can you elaborate on the systematic enslavement and annihilation of California natives by the mission system?
I actually have a chapter on New Mexico and California. I mean, And what I find, even though people really ask a lot about the missions, and clearly the missions, and I do talk about some of the missions, clearly there was a great deal of coercion in the missions. Really, the worst instances of enslavement occurred after the missions were dissolved by the Mexican government in 1833-34. It was a well-meaning type of order. The idea was that the land of the former missions would be parceled out among some of these neophytes, the Indians who had been in the missions, that cattle and tools would be distributed among some of these Indians, and that they would become small farmers. That was the plan. The reality was that there was a land grab by well-connected individuals who carved out these enormous ranches, some of which are around us, Petaluma, Vallejo, and all of these.
Sonoma.
Right. Yeah, exactly. 100 ranches with really princely domains, and somebody needed to work in those ranches. And this is a time, so the 1830s, 1840s, in which African slavery had been abolished by Mexico in 1828-29, so at least technically there were some African slaves, but not too many, and it was illegal to have African slaves in California. So that was not a viable, reliable source of labor. The coolie trade had not reached maturity until much later. There were a few people from Hawaii working in some of these ranches, but it was not a very significant in terms of numbers, as it would be later on in the 1860s, 70s. So during this period, if you had a ranch, the only viable source of labor were Native Americans. And they were inducted into these ranches by either some of these former missionized Indians, because they had no resources, had to put themselves under the protection of these California ranchers, powerful California ranchers, in conditions that, again, resembled bondage, or in some other cases, even more insightful, were some of the Indians that had remained outside of the mission system were subjected to raids. So Vallejo, our friend Vallejo himself, he was the military commander of Northern California, and therefore he had a military force of about 80 strong, many of whom were Indians, interestingly enough, and they would go out, raid Indians, bring Indians forcibly, transport them into the ranches, and get them to work. So again, it took different forms, but those were the most egregious cases of enslavement that I found in California in these ranches.
A couple of our guests here this evening would like you to talk more about some of the things you just mentioned. One, about the slavery of female Native Americans, because you did mention that, and that there was in African-American slavery, there was a tendency more toward males for the type of agricultural
males,
labor.
Yeah.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Correct. And then you had mentioned that it was more females.
Yep.
And children.
Yep.
In this case. So if you could please address that, and then we'll flip the script a little, and there's another interesting question on the other side.
Again, this is a very interesting phenomenon, that to the extent that there are prices, that you find prices of Indians who were bought and sold, you see that that adult women could command much higher prices, as much as 50% higher, 60% higher. And this price premium was true both in the 16th century Caribbean, in the 17th century southern Chile, in 19th century northern New Mexico. So this price premium was really something persistent over a very large geographic area, to the extent that we have prices. And so what explains that? Well, I mean, the easy answer would be that, of course, part of it had to do with the sexual possibilities of females. It may also have to do with other things, that the work was valuable, more valuable, that the work of females were more valuable in raising children than adult males, indigenous males, some of whom, especially nomadics, who were really skilled hunters, but that kind of skill was not really in high demand in an agricultural society, for example. In the case of children, it's easier to see why the scale was adult females at the top, then girls coming next, then boys, and then adult males way down at the bottom of the price scale. Children were, of course, more adaptable than adults. They could learn languages more easily. And the greatest advantage, perhaps, was that they could identify with their captors in the fullness of time. So one of the things that makes this slavery different from African slavery is that it was not necessarily passed down from one generation to another, but that even in the course of a lifetime, some of these native slaves could work themselves into a menial position.
Well, so on a related note, someone talks about, clearly what you're illuminating is the longest Holocaust in history, which also dovetails and is eclipsed by the slavery of women worldwide. And of course, in the United States today, it's estimated that there are roughly 4 million sex slaves. And if you put that number in historical context, that's roughly the same number of African-American slaves there were in 1860. Pretty significant, yet widely ignored or underreported. But this question asks more specifically, what became of the Comanche? And was there a difference in the treatment or status of enslaved women from initial enslavement on Hispaniola?
One of the very interesting things about the use of native slaves in the mines was that we may think that it was mostly adult males, but it was not. Males and females were used, and children were especially prized because they could actually crawl into small places. So they had a really good place in these mining enterprises. So yes, they were widely used even in the mining economy, and the mining business may have been one of the largest, if not the largest, native slave-related activity. What became of the Comanches? Well, the Comanches created this powerful confederation that essentially supplied horses, captives, hides to other Indians, as well as to Spaniards in New Mexico, and Mexicans in New Mexico, as well as to French on the other side and English. In the 19th century, they actually expanded into Mexico. So one of the very interesting things is that familiar historical events take new meaning when you think about slavery. So, for example, the Mexican-American War resulted in the redrawing of the boundaries between Mexico and the United States. The Comanches ended up on the American side, but they could now go raid into Mexico, which was full of horses and peoples, and then they would cross the border into the United States, where Mexican troops would not be able to follow in pursuit because they would be entering a different country. One of the interesting articles of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which was negotiated at the end of the war between Mexico and the United States, Article 11, was that Americans should refrain from buying captives, Indian or Mexican captives, which indicates just the extent of the problem. Basically, so many of these groups, and Apaches did that to a much lesser extent too. Apaches had been one of the most heavily enslaved indigenous groups in the silver mines in Mexico. But in the 19th century, some of them turned the tables on their erstwhile masters, and they went into Mexico to raid, to get captives, and then sold them in the United States. So again, that really changes your perspective of how to see an event like the U.S.-Mexico War and the redrawing of the boundary.
There was a related question about the Spanish silver mines. Actually, the Roman Empire, one of our audience members writes, also had a voracious demand for slaves in Spanish silver mines, and because of the presence of mercury and lead in the mines, that obviously means that the slave workers would not last very long from exposure. And could this similarly be related to the scale of the need for slaves in the American mines?
Well, first of all, to me, it's still extremely difficult to explain how work was organized in some of these mines, right? So take the big mine of Parral was the one that I really looked at in great detail, this mine in what is now southern Chihuahua that essentially refashioned life in New Mexico. And when you look at Parral, you see that these mines were being worked by Native American slaves, African slaves, some slaves that had been actually brought from Asia, if you can believe this. People from the Indian subcontinent had been sold into the Philippines, which was a Spanish possession at the time in the 17th century, 18th centuries, and then brought to Acapulco and then up through Mexico City all the way to northern Mexico. So there were some of these Chinese Indians, as they were called, in the silver mines, as well as salaried workers. And so it's hard to imagine, first of all, how these operations actually work, where you have these very different types of workers rubbing shoulders with one another. So that's number one. And number two, what's really fascinating is that it changes your perception of how the work is valued. So an African slave in Parral was a lot more expensive than an Indian slave. So an African slave would be worth anywhere between 400, 500, 600 pesos in the middle of the 17th century. An Indian slave was worth anywhere like 80, 100, 120 pesos, which meant that if you were totally rational, owner of the mine, you would actually leave your very expensive African slaves do the more skilled above ground activities related to the mine, and you would send the Indian slaves down into the below the ground operations, because if you lost one of your African slaves, that would be a major financial loss to a cave-in or whatever, whereas if you lost an Indian slave, that would be far less costly.
If you could explain briefly, how is it to go about doing the kind of research that you do and that you did for this book? In other words, where are you going to find the primary resources, and what kind of resources are you getting to do these demographic studies?
It is a detective story, mm-hmm. really. I mean, because Indian slavery was outlawed, it technically didn't occur. Yet, there is a continuous paper trail, right? So it comes up in assorted documentation for every region of the New World. And so what I did was to find a special flashpoints. So, for example, I have one chapter in which the Spanish crown, for reasons of the conscience of the Spanish king, he goes into an empire-wide campaign to stamp out Indian slavery. And so I found this documentation of the Spanish monarchy essentially writing to various governors from Chile, from the Philippines, from New Mexico, telling them, you need to get rid of this. You need to crack down on this. You need to liberate the Indian slaves that you have. And so these are the moments that I latch onto in order to weave together the story. And it is an eye-opening moment, because you realize, oh, my God. I mean, it lays out the slaving grounds and you realize that it's happening all over the New World.
An indigenous history of the United States makes the case that intentional genocide was most responsible for decimating native communities. How would you compare the impact of military genocide with the impact of slavery?
Well, I mean, again, this is not an either or. Both of these things were occurring. What I would say, and what some other scholars have actually noted, is that there is a vicious circle connecting slavery and epidemics, which is important to realize. So epidemics, essentially what it means is that your workers are dying and you need to replace them. So you send out slaving raids to replenish the workers that you are losing. And by doing that, you are spreading disease, which again lead to further decimation of the indigenous peoples. So the two processes, slavery and epidemics, are linked in this vicious circle. So that, to me, is a very powerful, and it is a very easy to document in the case of the Caribbean, for example. Paul Kelton, another historian, has also documented for the East Coast of the United States. It's a phenomenon worth keeping in mind.
So another query asks for your comment about, in California, where logging contractors hired indigenous Guatemalan, indigenous Mexican peoples to plant trees in the national forests, and then turned them into immigration services for deportation so that they were never paid.
Oh, God.
Can you talk about that cycle? Well, that's certainly cycle of exploitation.
Yeah.
And we have some of that now, maybe with the visa programs mm-hmm. and things where your people are being promised certain things to come mm-hmm. into the country, and then they find themselves in sort of a cycle of slavery because they're in some nebulously legal state. And these people would obviously have no recourse.
My book does not get to the 20th century. I do stop in the 19th century. However, I will say that some of the techniques being used are classic techniques that have precedents going back to the 19th, 18th, 17th centuries, and certainly using the legal system as a mechanism of enslavement is a classic way of doing things.
So as we near the conclusion of the Q&A here, just a couple more points. One was, again, back to the epilogue, because we'll try to bring things a little bit up to the present, but certainly we live in the present, and history provides great context for that. And given that this is really a lot of an untold history. What's your view in terms of the way this, the narratives that you present here, the information you present here, if people were more aware of this, how do you find that potentially changing some of the contemporary narrative?
Well, my thoughts are twofold about this. One is that the story of the enslavement of Indians, this 400-year experience, gives us a sense that it's not a story that is finished. It's an ongoing phenomenon that reaches up all the way to the present. And so it is an ongoing battle. It's not something that occurred in the past and then we conquered and now we're living happily ever after. No, it is an ongoing phenomenon, number one. And number two, it is a recognition that those who benefit from exploited labor are extremely adaptable, extremely capable of using any legal context, any new policies, etc., to make the most of the exploitation of others. And so therefore, ending that really requires a real commitment and real vigilance. One of the insights of the book is that these slavers, even if they were periodically these campaigns to eliminate this type of slavery, yet they simply moved. If they were targeting the Apaches, then they targeted the Navajos or other groups. So they move to a different group to target, or they move to a different region, or they adapted and changed the wording, or changed from jailing to debts. I mean, so they are extremely adaptable, and so a real push to try to end or at least minimize these phenomena requires ever constant vigilance and a real commitment. So that would be my central point.
Well, Professor, University of California, Davis, and historian Andres Resendez, your latest work is The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. Thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
That's our program for this week. We heard a speech by historian and author Andres Resendez. He's a professor at University of California, Davis. He was discussing the little-known subject of slavery imposed on Native Americans. His book on the topic, out by Houghton Mifflin, is called The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips and I are executive producers. Anthony Fest is our producer and Erica Bridgman, our engineer. Please go online to Facebook and follow us or see our website at projectcensored.org. Contact us through our website if you have ideas for future programs. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip our brothers and our sisters.